Like I said, as a monk, I was born in Thailand, that's why I ordained, but certainly grew up in Australia, where I spent 8 years with Ajahn Brahm training at Bodhinyana Monastery, and been away for the last year and a half in Buddha Dhamma, just practicing over there, but also trying to reestablish the center as a forest monastery. And if I'd like to share some of my experiences and just some of my reflections about, you know, what happened in the last year and a half. And first, you know, just say, like I said, it's great to be back and to finally see Jhana Grove finished. I was here a year and a half ago and it was partially done, and now to see the beautiful hall, the cottage, it's amazingly big, very luxurious. I hope many people will experience much peace and tranquility and wisdom practicing in the center. And also appreciate, you know, it's only after I'm a senior monk at Wat Buddha Dhamma to appreciate all the hard work that many people put into, you know, getting a place going, especially Ajahn Brahm, to get anything started. It's a huge amount of work. And now that I'm doing some maintenance work, you appreciate every little thing you see in front of you, that someone had to, you know, come out, you know, cut the piece of wood, they have to varnish it, refine it, and then put it here for, you know, for the monks to use. So, you know, the fact that, you know, like I said, so doing that just gives me a new appreciation for walking into, you know, Dhamma Hall, looking around at the Bodhinyana Monastery, to appreciate how much hard work that's gone into building anything, and to bring that up to make sure that, you know, I use it for its purpose of, you know, achieving much peace, working on the wisdom faculty, and you know, for the welfare and happiness of all beings. So it is, just to mention that, that was really nice. But also, being a senior monk, not only appreciating, you know, what's hard work, how much work has gone ahead, and that, you know, also kind of reflecting as a monk, you know, you are dependent on so many people, and the goodness of people come. Obviously, the hard work of the different monks who come ahead of you, and also the support of the lay people who come to offer us things, that you always, you know, keep that in mind, that, you know, we are basically at heart mendicant beggars, and to, you know, and that it brings to mind a sense of appreciation. Because when you appreciate something, you reflect that the positive things, what you already have, you know, appreciation leads naturally to contentment, which is, you know, leads to stillness and peace. When you're happy with somebody, you look at the good side, you appreciate them, you don't look at their fault. You don't say, oh, you know, so-and-so is okay, but, you know, he's doing this wrong. You know, appreciation just leads to bright states of mind and to contentment. And contentment is a great thing, because it cuts away a lot of the work that comes into a fault-finding mind. Because, you know, if you're not happy, then you have to do things. You have to change things. You're happy with your husband, then it's great. You don't have to do anything. But you're not, then you have to start out by, you know, trying to change him, move things. You know, proceed for divorce, or, you know, look for a new husband. It's a lot of work in non-contentment. And reminds me of a story that I heard when I was back in the States a few years ago, told by a very nice Catholic priest. It has to do with the beggar boy and the priest. And the story goes something like this. I think it's in New York somewhere. And there's this beggar boy. He gets up every morning, and he goes to this corner to try to sell some bagels. And there's a priest who lives not so far away from that corner. So every day he does this exercise. He runs, you know, around the blocks a few times. And he sees this boy sitting there, you know, trying to set up his stand, very cold morning. And he's, you know, getting things ready, open up the thing. So he jogs down there first time, second time, then, you know, maybe third time around, he throws the boy 2 quarters. And smiles to the boy and just waves and keeps on walking. The boy's like, okay, whatever. I thought maybe he'll come back and pick it up later once he finishes his exercise, but he never does. And this happens, you know. He doesn't, I guess he sees the boy once a week or something. It happens for, you know, a few weeks, a few months, and he never stops for his bagel. just throws the two quarters, smiles, and waves. The boy waves back. It's like, okay, whatever. And then one day, as the priest was, you know, jogging by the boy, again, he throws two quarters, and the boy really waved, stopped him. And the priest smiles and says, you know, I bet you're wondering why I always, you know, throw the two quarters to you, but I never stop for my bagels. And the boy said, no, that's not why I stopped you. I just want to tell you that today the price of bagels has gone up to 60 cents. That has to do with appreciation and contentment. We're happy and we're like, oh, you know, it's 50 cents is great, but we're not content. We say, no, I want that extra down. I want more things. Happiness is getting more. And also for us to reflect, to always to appreciate. You know, appreciation leads to peace, leads to stillness, less doing. And anything the Buddha said, anything that leads to peace, to harmony, is teaching the Dhamma. Because it leads to, you know, less doing, leads to being still, allowing the mind. And it's this kind of skills that is not only, you know, good for us to apply on a daily level, peace and harmony, to live in peace, to look for our commonality, and not to exaggerate the differences. Obviously, we are dealing, you know, it's not to say that we are in denial that everything is one big happy world and we're all the same. We're not the same, obviously. We have our own causes and conditions. But sometimes when we do, you know, kind of emphasize the different things that set us apart, then it leads to confrontation, it leads to divisiveness. So the practice of looking for good things in other people, what we have in common, especially the wholesome qualities that we share with each other, you know, leads to a community, united community, who can live in peace and harmony. But also, deeper than that, it enhances, empowers our own meditation practice. Because you learn how to live in peace in everyday life. When you sit, you also learn to make peace with whatever's happening in the mind. Whether the mind is talkative, noisy, or distracted, it's not a problem. When the Buddha sat down the Bodhi tree and when he was enlightened, you know, even during the time of the Buddha, he was a wonderful person with many beautiful qualities and powers, but he still lived in a world of strife. There was wars, there's famines, there's lots of kind of, you know, not so nice things that happened during his time. And he said that, and he didn't try to set out to achieve world peace. He didn't set out to achieve a perfect place on earth, because he knew that was an impossibility. But what he did, which was more powerful, where it was more, you know, kind of has more influence, was that he made peace with the existing conditions, right? And that's where perfection lies. It doesn't lie in creating a perfect world out there when we get everybody to do what we want to do, to say what they should be saying. And that goes for, you know, your partners, it goes for monks and nuns that you love and respect. Now, you don't always do what you want. And you live with any master, you will know very quickly. Yes, they have their wonderful qualities. But they can also be very trying. But that's not a bad thing. Because it points to your own kind of, you know, our own projections into what perfection is. And I think with the teaching is that, even with the Buddha, with Ajahn Chah, you know, I remember, you know, Ajahn Sumedho, you know, was telling a story, he tells it often, that he in the beginning, he was very inspired by Ajahn Chah, wanted to come to live, this wonderful master, Thai, who practiced and who was, you know, has a reputation of being enlightened. So he wants to train with Ajahn Chah, was very inspired, and the first few years it was. And then later, he says, well, you know, he's doing this wrong. He says not to eat in the afternoon, but I've seen him putting food aside. Is he eating in the afternoon? Maybe he is. Or he says, you know, whatever, there's morning, evening chanting at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he doesn't always show up on time, you know. There's all these little things comes out, and one day he got so frustrated, he went to Ajahn Chah and says, you know, Ajahn Chah, you said about all these things, but you don't do them yourself. You're full of mistakes, and your chanting is bad, and you don't show up on time, and you wear your robes sloppily, And Ajahn Chah, you know, of course, being enlightened, just started laughing. He said, yes, yes, of course. I said, of course I'm not perfect. If I were perfect, then you'd be looking for perfection out there. And it's not. You'd be looking for the Buddha outside of yourself. Yeah. You should be looking for the Buddha inside yourself. And that's why sometimes, you know, we pay homage to the Buddha. A lot of it is, yeah, it's the historical Buddha, but a lot of it is just our own potential for awakening, our own potential to purify our own mind. We had a Waisak celebration a few weeks ago, and that's the thing I tried to kind of impress on the people come to the monastery, that the wonderful thing about the Buddha, the thing that I find really amazing, really is that really rocks. It's not the fact, okay, his enlightenment is really cool, obviously, being enlightened, be happy forever, and, you know, kind of even, and just, you know, nothing, no unwholesome state of mind to come up. It's pretty amazing. But the other thing I find really amazing about the Buddha's life is the fact that he was a human being. He wasn't a god. He wasn't half a god, a quarter of god. He had regular parents. He had, you know, two eyes, two ears, a nose, a mouth. And what I find so amazing about that is because the fact that by his own effort, he became enlightened as a human being. Right? So it had great implication for each and every one of us because he taught the Dhamma in a way that we can also become enlightened. And it's just remember that when, you know, the Buddha is obviously a historical figure. But also, when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're also taking refuge in our own potential, inner potential, to purify our own mind, to incline it towards wholesome states and away from unwholesome states. And that comes around by first, I find, from my own practice, is gratitude and contentment. Gratitude for the hard work that's been done by, you know, the elders in the Sangha, appreciating how much hard work Ajahn Brahm did to build up Bodhinyana Monastery, to build up a center, and to help support the nuns in Dhammasara, as well as, you know, to build up a jhana grove. And to know that's not easy. And also, to also appreciate, you know, how much hard work Lumpur Samedo made in terms of establishing monasteries in England, providing opportunities for the Siladharas, the nuns, to establish and to live in harmony. That was kind of revolutionary 30 years ago. I have to appreciate that as well, and not to get lost in the controversy sometimes. And with gratitude, it's really beautiful states of mind. So instead of looking for the faults, we appreciate all the positive qualities that's gone ahead. And with that, I feel like as a monk, you're living off kind of the tailcoat, you know, the tailcoats of the Buddha, obviously, the enlightened masters, and the monks and nuns. Because a few weeks ago or something, I was traveling somewhere. And also, you know, what Buddha Dhamma being a very isolated monastery, secluded, there's always an issue. People come and say, well, you know, you're only a few monks, you know, two monks here. What happens if people don't come and feed you? They don't come every day. They don't. They only come on the weekends to offer the food. And then during the week, hopefully there's somebody there who is practicing, or somewhere there, and they usually cook up the food for us. But it's not always a sure thing, because being a new monastery, people come and go. So some of the people say, why don't you make it easy? Why don't you guys just cook your own food, or use some money? And it's always that question that comes up, you know, this is kind of Australia, why don't we change things? Be more kind of rational, more practical. But then, and it seems practical enough, but now I reflect, you know, that's where I kind of relied on the Barami, relied on all the work of Lumpur Samedo and Ajahn Pasano made in the early days. When they came to England, you know, Ajahn Amrong, there was no, you know, obviously Buddhism was very new. But they had this faith in Ajahn Chah, faith in tradition. But said, no, you know, no, we don't use money. And we're not going to use money. No matter what, we have to fast a few days. It's not a problem. So just reflect on that. You know, there have been monasteries in the West for 25, 30 years. They've never had to use money, never had to cook for themselves. So, you know, why should I start now? So it gives me faith. Obviously, sometimes you think, oh, yeah, well, maybe someone doesn't show up. Now what I do? You know, it's like, oh. So there's always that worry when you're a kind of relatively young monk, you know, thinking, you know, it's a fireplace. You know, it takes about 2.5 hours to get to what Buddhadhamma. And the different things happen. Sometimes they get lost or whatever along the way. So this issue comes up. Go, huh. But knowing the fact that there are monasteries in the West and people have been practicing with the same discipline and they've survived and thrived gives me this faith and confidence that, you know, yeah, I can follow along. It's no big deal. And I, you know, and I find that, yeah, no, it is a great resource to rely on. To know that I'm a tradition, in the tradition that has, you know, kind of survived the test of time so far. And like I said, so that's why sometimes that, you know, and you can see that you have a lot of faith in a tradition, you have a lot of gratitude, and also you receive the benefits of the practice. Then the gratitude arises naturally. Faith arises naturally. When you read the Buddha's, you know, kind of the text, the suttas, and you listen to the Dhamma talks of the teachers, and that gives some faith and some inspiration. But that's very short-lived, because it's something, you know, that inspiration lasts for a little bit. But until we kind of taste peace for ourselves, then those things are just more concepts. That's why I always kind of encourage people to, you know, obviously to pay attention to what the teacher said, but also to do more than that. Respect for the teacher doesn't always, and the teaching doesn't always come down to bowing and kind of groveling around the senior monks. But the best thing you do by, you know, in terms of showing the respect for the Buddha and all the teachers that have gone ahead of us is actually to put the practice into every day and to realize the fruits of what they're talking about. To really practice loving kindness, to practice giving people the benefit of the doubt, to practice compassion. And then once we see you know, the benefit, that we see the good karma of doing wholesome things, then it's no longer a theory. It's a fact. Right? We don't have to rely on what other people say, what peace feels like. You have a good meditation, we know. So I just encourage people to kind of bring the practice into your life each and every day. I mean, the practice is just not for monks and nuns. It's something we can do. And also to encourage people, I don't know whether this is the right forum to address, but something that I guess is happening over the last few months, is that, you know, whatever the external conditions outside is, just to go back to the basics. To always know that, you know, like being an abbot and get very busy with kind of worldly activities. And sometimes we take the activities to be life. That's what life is about. And then when, you know, but actually for myself, I find that actually it's when we sit with ourselves and we pay attention to the present moment, one breath after another, that's where life is at. We're only really human being by being here. Being in the present moment, appreciating what that feels like. Connecting, you know, to our inner selves or inner non-selves as we're sitting here. we're moving around, we don't have mindfulness, then we're not really living. So just reflect on that. So everything else is shadow play. The pros and cons, whatever happens to the World Cup, whoever wins, whether you are for or against Bhikkhuni ordination, and that comes and goes. But how is your practice? Are you suffering and are you making efforts to decrease that suffering? Are you moving towards unity, peace, and harmony? Or are you advocating division? And just to bring it back to a practice, it's a practice of kindness, of compassion. Nothing else. No, the only thing, like I said, you probably already guessed that as a monk, we don't really plan for talks. Whatever comes out, comes out. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's less than desirable. But I always remember something. There was the one thing nice, like I said, was kind of, you know, being back in Bodhinyana Monastery. It's the sense of kind of like a sense of family bonding with my brothers in the holy life. That, you know, we are very different characters, as one monk said. You know, the people that you have to be with, spend your time with in the monastery, are the same people. He would, if you see him coming on the street, he would cross the street to go the other way. But being a monk, you don't have any choice. You know, whoever ordains with you sits to your left, and ordains, you know, earlier sits to the right. Obviously, nothing to do with your preference. And it's a great training in that way. But also over time, being there for 8 years, we've developed something deeper than our own kind of views and opinions. We don't always agree on everything. As a matter of fact, we rarely agree on many things. But we can still talk about it. And that's why the coffee club is great. Obviously, we have, you know, after the meal, we kind of sit around and we have coffee with each other or tea or whatever. It's just to kind of... sometimes people, some people say, and we can be quite rowdy, and some people think, oh, you know what, you guys, well, why am I feeding you guys? The things you discuss in your coffee club. But nonsense. But being back, reflect on the wholesome qualities of it. It's just the bonding. It doesn't matter what was said, who said what to whom, or whether you agree with, you know, the views and opinions. The fact that it was just time just to sit there and share things. And that, to me, I felt was really, really nice, just to be here, and obviously, you know, being more of a traditionalist, I have certain views and opinions, and, you know, obviously Ajahn Brahmale has different views and opinions, but we can still talk about it, and at the end of the day, agree to disagree, which is fine. It's not a problem. We're not clones of each other. We don't have to follow the party line. And that's the nice thing about, you know, being a monk who, you know, grown up in Australia, that there is, I think, the openness to allow people to be themselves, to allow differences, to allow individuality, and also allow people to ask any questions, you know, that are, you know, that they don't understand. There's no such thing, and that's why I find, you know, the training of Bodhinyana is incredibly useful in that way. There's never a question that you cannot ask regarding a monk or a nun up here. And in the end, you don't have to agree. But I always say I would express my views, whatever it's worth, and opinions about a certain subject. And you can contemplate that and work with that. And I find, you know, just the communal harmony of being in a Sangha, and just in the kind of bonding that we have was quite special. That's like I say, we don't have to agree. But that's okay, because our friendship is deeper than that. It's deeper than any views you might hold about anything. It's deeper what we, you know, where I may be. The sense that, okay, there is enough respect and trust in each other to do the right thing. That I find is immensely helpful to live in any community, to any relationship. And the reflection I had, was saying earlier, in terms of contentment. Contentment, I find, is this great, sharp diamond sword that cuts away all the craving. Because, like I said, when you're content, it leads towards stillness, inextricably. And when you're not content, it's when it leads towards movement, complication, diversification, because you have to do things, manage and change. So, practice of contentment. It's like anything, it's a practice, right? Training the mind is a practice, and that's what Buddhism is. Buddhism, I like to tell people, is not a noun. It's not something you read about. It's not something you, kind of more knowledge. It's not a concept. Buddhism is a verb, something you do. We're not Buddhist because we're born into it, we belong to a certain family or a clan or a class, or sexual orientation. No, we're Buddhist because something we do, our intention towards harmlessness, towards peace and kindness. And it's the training that we do for our entire life. And to kind of keep that in mind, keep the reflection, am I moving towards peace and harmony? Moving towards compassion? Or am I moving away from that? And to have this mindfulness, just to reflect, not to give yourself a hard time. Because sometimes we do that, oh, I'm a Buddhist, and I have this terrible thought, no, evil. I have to tell Ajahn Brahm, well, Ajahn Brahm, what should I do? What penance should I do? And he would say, you just go 50 strokes of the cat. And so to accept. To bring mindfulness and say, okay, these thoughts I have are unwholesome. And that's fine, because I say, okay, I'm not enlightened, so I will have greed, anger, and delusion from time to time. And to accept that from time to time. But also to allow, to use whatever training you can, to allow, to let that go. To kind of not engage in it, not pushing away, but not engaging in it as well. And then moving, steering the mind slowly towards wholesome states, just forgiveness, giving people the benefit of the doubt. And it's something I encourage people, to do and see for yourself. When you do wholesome things, what does that feel like? So always have mindfulness. When you do something unwholesome, when you say something mean, you hurt somebody, hurt an animal, see what that feels like. Because once the mind knows what is happiness and what is suffering, then we're inclined towards happiness automatically. It's not something we have to do so much. Only initially there is some effort to be set up, some mindfulness. For us, you progress along the path, build up the wholesome habits, then the mind works on its own. So just to know there's conditioning. But initially we have to create the right condition. Like the Buddha said, Buddhism can be, can be very complicated. It can get very technical. We have 4 meters worth of suttas for you to read. But the Buddha summed it down. And there's a beautiful plaque in that, in Dhammaloka. Buddhism really boils down to, right? Avoid evil actions, to do what is good, and to purify the mind. So let's just reflect it over. What am I doing? Am I avoiding evil, I might continue to do good, and to train my mind in whatever ways I can. And the fact that the Buddha, I told you, was a human being, he did that. And then, by knowing enlightened monks and nuns who became enlightened through practicing the Buddhist teaching, gives us great faith, gives me great faith and confidence that something that, you know, still can be done in this day and age, each and every one of us, through persistence, through cultivation, mindfulness, we can purify our own mind. And just not for ourselves, for the welfare and happiness of all beings. Because we know when you're unhappy, when you're tired, grumpy, what does that happen? We're not happy. There's no way we can make anybody else happy. And that is a natural law in the mind. Sometimes we have good intention and want to, you know, be of service, be of use to people, and make a difference in the community we live in. But we have issues to deal with. We have anger issues, greed issues, then that's going to take precedence over anybody else. So the best thing we can do for the community, best thing we can do for our partners and families and, you know, sons and daughters and children, is first to purify our minds, to devote some time to meditation. As the famous philosopher said, Madonna, he says, "Until I learn to love myself, I'm never going to love anybody else." See? She must be a Buddhist in her past life. Like I said, those are the kind of reflections I offer you for tonight. I came, like I said, to give a talk and to offer some teachings, 9-day retreat, out of gratitude to Ajahn Brahm, who obviously gave me almost perfect conditions to train my mind in the Bodhidharma Monastery for the last 8 years. But also, out of gratitude, I'd like to dedicate this also to Lumpur Sumedho and other Thai monks who also became inspired and to ordain there. May this be a cause and conditions for peace and harmony as we move forward. And may we practice for the welfare and happiness of all beings. Okay, so that's our affliction for you tonight. Okay, any questions or comments? If I don't like the question, we're not going to broadcast it, right? No. Yes? Yes, no, that's a very good question. And for myself anyway, because over different, you know, practicing the monastery for many years, what I did in Buddha Dhamma, knowing I was very busy, was I set up very regular morning and evening chanting and meditation sessions. And then to set up, when I sit down, I set up, you know, instead of, like I was telling you before, instead of thinking life is what I do outside of meditation. No, I set up my mindfulness to recognize that life is what I do during my meditation. Everything else is shadow play. Yes, you know, the toilet gets fixed, it doesn't get fixed, the roof has a leak, sometimes it has a leak, and sometimes it doesn't have a leak. Things come and go, people come and practice and they go. But basically, the most important thing for me is one breath. In breath and out breath at that moment. So I think I would recommend, if you can have the conditions, was that to have a regular practice, something to really center the mind. And then also, what you find is that, yes, when you do sit down, the mind will not be peaceful. because, you know, you've got responsibilities and the jobs and family. It will move. But that's still okay. At least you're giving yourself, you know, whatever, 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes of downtime, and allowing the mind just to process whatever the day's information is. Then you will be, I think, the mind has that chance to rest. It will kind of re-energize automatically and be brighter. And then, yes, you may be making a mistake, but at least the fact that you're recognizing after the fact that you made a mistake, that will program the mind. Okay, next time this situation, I will try to steer away from, you know, this unwholesome state of mind. I will react more with kindness, with forgiveness, instead of reacting from anger or jealousy or hurt. But also to know the practice is gradual. And you know, just to allow your time, yourself, the time just to progress and not to expect to get, you know, results very quickly. Yeah, there's a lady, like I said, we were teaching on Armadale a few years ago, and she was very a regular attendant of every Tuesday night. We have this Armadale session, and she comes, you know, almost every Tuesday. And then one day we had a sharing session, and she was saying that she comes very regularly, but not because her meditation was very peaceful or anything. She said there was not. When she sat down, it was all over the place, you know, kind of digesting the day's events. She had a teenage daughter that, you know, obviously kept her on her toes most of the time. And she said that, so her mind was quite busy when she sat down. But she kept coming because she noticed that outside of her meditation, that she was quite, you know, her relationship with the people around her changed over time, the last 6 months, that she didn't lose her temper as quick as she did before. And she didn't carry around the negativity so, you know, for so long. So even though the mind was, you know, the meditation wasn't peaceful, obviously it had a positive effect on her life. And just to notice that as well, and to appreciate that. Yeah. Is that helpful?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good. Right. Okay. We're good. Any questions or comments? Complaints? And you have to go to Dennis. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think contentment cuts craving in the sense that you said you have a house. If you said, oh, this house is getting small, it's too old, it's too rickety, then you've got to look around how to fix it or have to work harder to buy a bigger house. So by being happy with, you know, your smaller house or your, you know, not so new house, it creates less work, right? So it cuts away the doing more thing and getting more. So you're happy with your job, so you look at trying to look at the positive things. So contentment help, you know, to have contentment, you have to constantly focus on the positive things in life, the positive in the situation, in yourself, in another person. Then you grow in contentment, and when you're content, then you don't want anything else. That's what the true meaning of contentment is. You say, this house is good enough, but, well, that's not true contentment. So you're trying to focus on more and more contentment. And then, like I said, and basically, the more you practice, then whatever you have in front of you is good enough because you have contentment. And if it isn't good enough, then it leads to doing more things. You have to change it. You have to make it better. So it leads to more work, more, you know, distractions. So that's why I said contentment, you know, leads to stillness, and it cuts craving. Because craving always leads to more doing. So it's just to kind of sit down one day and say, am I doing more or less than a month ago? Just to check how much, you know, contentment you have or how much craving there is in the mind. Yeah, does that make sense? Okay.
That helps you abandon the craving.
That's right. That's right. It's going to let it go. It's going to make peace with it.